So the talk is about kindness and generosity, and these are things I think we can probably agree that we could use a little bit more of both of these and all of these in our world today. I'll just start with a quote from Winston Churchill, who says, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." And just to reflect on that as we open up. So I know for myself, my own interest in places like Cambridge Insight Meditation Center and finding a spiritual path were because I was looking for something different in life than the standard path, something different than our culture's kind of rampant materialism and the promises of pleasure. And maybe we were seeking more happiness or quieting the suffering of loss or anxiety or illness. And the Buddha himself spoke about suffering. He said, "I teach two things. I teach suffering, and I teach the end of suffering." And he taught these through the Four Noble Truths, which I think a lot of us are probably familiar with. And these came to him after a long, long meditation. And so the first thing he said was that life is suffering. Or we might say these days, life is stressful. And I certainly have found that to be true. Anyone disagree with this first noble truth, that life is stressful? Okay, so we're starting from a good place. And he went on to say, stress and suffering, these are caused by wanting things, not wanting other things, and just by our kind of general confusion about everything. And he said, it really doesn't have to be this way, and that there's a way out, and that's the Noble Eightfold Path. And this is really true. This has been so true in my experience anyway, this idea that wanting things to be different or wanting certain things in life, whether it's material things or whether it's the job or whether it's the partner or the house or the car, right? Like these cause suffering. And even when we get those things, right, we still suffer wanting to hang on to them, or that job or that car or that partner isn't quite as perfect as we necessarily wanted them to be, or they could be just a little bit better, right? Well, why can't this be a little bit more like this? Even the people we love, an old mentor of mine used to say, everyone you love has at least one thing about them that makes you damn near want to kill them. And I feel like that's such helpful advice, just to recognize that we're all imperfect. And when we start to work with that, that's when things can start to get better. So if we understand that stress and suffering are the result of desire, and we can see that the amount of suffering is really related to the urgency of desire, then the solution also really becomes pretty clear. So the antidote to craving, to wanting, attachment, greed, and desire is generosity, right? Generosity allows us to detach. When we share and let go of things, that actually makes room. It makes space. It makes space in our basement when we give stuff away. It makes space in our heart. It makes space in our mind when we start to give things away. And when we give things away, also, that's a benefit to others. And so while the solution might sound simple, I think, it's hardly easy. So I want to talk about sort of some Buddhist notions of generosity tonight, as well as some of the scientific notions of generosity. And part of what makes it hard is that we're up against some of the more selfish angels of our nature. The DNA, right? Our evolutionary hardwiring has kind of told us to survive. We want to hoard more than we need in order to survive. And we're also not just up against nature, we're up against nurture. We're up against a culture that tells us that wanting and getting, that all of these things are going to be what makes us happy. We get all these messages telling us getting that thing will make us happier than giving anything. And it feels kind of quaint looking back at the George W. Bush era, but I remember after 9/11, does anyone remember what he said after 9/11? He said that, and he said go shopping. Oh. He said that's how we can heal as a country. Go to Disney World and go shopping. And so, despite nearly every spiritual tradition, every philosophical tradition, all the scientific evidence, right, tells us that lasting health and happiness comes through giving and not through getting. I think it's Jack Kornfield who says, our culture creates unlimited desires in a world of limited resources. when in fact what we need is the opposite, a culture of limiting our desire, and that's the only way that we can really live sustainably with each other, with our planet. And so it's also to me no wonder that the Buddha himself said that the path that he recommended, that he prescribed, was a path of rebellion. This was against the stream. This is an act of rebellion against our culture, against these messages telling us to get stuff. I was thinking about, you know, kind of holiday time or when, you know, like the new iPhones come out, which I always really like to get, I have to admit. But it's like, what if people were camped outside, you know, talking about a new opportunity to give rather than to get, right, in lines? If billboards were advertising giving rather than getting, right? And our entire culture might not necessarily change, and it won't change overnight, but we can really change. And we can really change others through generosity, and we can start to create really a ripple effect. And we might call this karma, this ripple effect, as we're kind of act in generous ways. There's other research that calls this a social contagion, or interpersonal neurobiology, that our actions start to really affect the people around us, kind of downstream. And I'll be talking about this as we go as well tonight. But what it really starts with is with us. And yet at the same time, it strikes me that it's kind of a shame that we need to teach generosity or preach generosity. And while I did say that evolution's wired into us this need to hoard, generosity and altruism are also wired into us. Some folks might know Chaz de Capua. He speaks here sometimes. I see some heads nodding. I heard him on a retreat a few years ago. He said this beautiful thing. He said, imagine a two-year-old, if anyone has like a two or three-year-old in their life, and imagine them walking up to you with something. And they're so happy to be giving that thing to you, to be showing you their toy, or sharing some piece of news with you when they, you know, race up to give you a hug, right? It's joyful to give, right? It gives us such pleasure to give. It's such a natural thing to do. And yet, you know, at the same time, imagine that two-year-old, right, in the checkout line when they really want that piece of candy, right? Or they just have to have that new toy for the holidays, right? It's just like incredible suffering for themselves, incredible suffering for everyone else around them. And I feel like this is such a beautiful image and an example. And I think also, you know, really we adults are not necessarily all that different, right? We don't stomp our feet in quite the same way. But we do get attached. We do get incredibly attached. Right? We want that thing. We need that job. We need that degree. We need that, you know, drink or that, you know, whatever our behaviors are that we all, you know, turn to in some ways. Or we get attached to that opinion, right, that we are right, right, rather than giving, you know, being generous of spirit and giving someone else's opinion the benefit of the doubt. Right? You only need to look at the online comments section of an article to see how attached people get to their ideas and the suffering that creates. And so these seeds of generosity, they're really in us. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh would say, you know, they're planted in us when we're born, and we can figure out how to water them, to grow them. And like so many other values, generosity is hardly monopolized by Eastern philosophy or by Buddhism. Pretty much every spiritual tradition, East and West, emphasizes generosity in some form. The Buddhists did have one system to kind of codify it as a practice. Christianity has its virtues, including caritas or tithing. Judaism emphasizes doing for others, and the ladder of tzedakah lays out these levels for giving, from begrudgingly through giving anonymously, and the highest gifts that create self-reliance. Hinduism and Islam speak of alms. Indigenous traditions all emphasize sharing. And sharing is caring, as I tell my three-year-old. But what does generosity really mean, and what did it mean as the Buddha talked about it? So he described that word that we've probably heard as well, dana. And dana is more than what you slip in the box when you come in the door, or that, you know, kind of guilt-trippy talk you get at the end of a retreat. Dana is really, it means unconditional giving. And the Buddha instructed that we give within our means, and we give what feels good to give. And the highest forms of giving are giving without expectation of being paid back. without expectation of being paid back with anything, even a thank you, even recognition. And so we want to be aware of this when we give. What are our intentions? Are we looking for some recognition in some ways? It reminds me a little bit of kind of, you know, metta practice and kind of loving kindness being the love of a parent to a child and or an idealized parent to a child. And that's, you know, same with giving, right? An idealized parent would just, you know, give to their child unconditionally in that same way. And I think this is actually especially true with those of us that are parents or caregivers or partners or colleagues, right? Like the golden rule, this is about kind of treating others, both strangers and friends and family, how we'd want to be treated. It's parenting, how we'd want to be parented. Or supervising at work, how we'd want to be supervised, or even driving down the street, how we'd want others to drive if we had a newborn child in the back seat or an aging parent in the back seat. And what this also means is not kind of reactively reenacting or reacting to imperfections of our own childhood or something like that, not rebelling or rejecting things altogether, but finding like a middle path with this giving. Giving what's best, giving the best of what we know, for one thing, passing on the good wisdom that we've acquired, maybe hard-won wisdom, not just passing on the mistakes and mistaken behaviors that we've experienced in life. And I think that brings us to another complicated question that I think our own practice or the Dharma or our Sangha can help us answer, which is discerning what's the middle path between generosity and obligation? What's doing our job as an employee, as a parent, as a partner, as a friend, and what's actually being generous? And on the other side, what's being generous and what's kind of spoiling or indulging or enabling, right? This kind of over-generosity in some ways that I think some of us, myself included, can certainly fall prey to. But again, this is where I think the Dharma can help and spiritual practice can help. So the Buddha also described types of generosity and intention being a really important quality of generosity. And he described giving with characteristics as one form of giving. And that means giving for a reason, with that kind of, you know, and this is giving as a form of repayment. It's like bringing flowers or a bottle of wine to a friend's house, or saying thank you, writing a thank you note, something like that. And that's a good thing, right? These create the causes and conditions under which good things are likely to emerge. You're likely to be closer. You're likely to be appreciated by these people, right? They're likely to see the positive in you. Your brain feels satisfied, and everyone feels kind of whole with that transaction, and it's social reciprocity like this that holds the fabric of our families together and our sanghas together and our larger communities together, this kind of reciprocity. And then there's also generosity with characteristics and intention. And this is a little bit different. This is that like giving with an agenda. And we all do this as well. Right? Maybe that's the intention of gaining recognition or earning spiritual merit, or being reciprocated in some ways, right? giving a big donation to your alma mater or to your local meditation center maybe, in the hopes that that'll be helpful to you at some other point, or giving the waiter a generous tip because you hope your date will notice, right? These are still good deeds, but the motives, and so therefore the kind of karma and the results that we get actually are different and a little bit more muddled, right? We might feel disappointed when, you know, the school we gave to doesn't return the favor, or when our kids apply to college, or when we don't get a second date, or something like that. So it's a setup for disappointment, this kind of giving with characteristics and intention. When we have these expectations, disappointment's waiting to happen. When there's no expectations, there's not as likely to be disappointment on either side. But the more there's this second agenda, the more unhappy we are, because we're attached to that outcome. Right? And any of these attachments are going to lead to suffering when the outcome isn't satisfactory to us or what we want it to be or expect it to be. And so giving without characteristics is, of course, ideal. Because I once heard also, I like this, expectations are resentments waiting to happen. Right? When we set ourselves up with expectations, we're just going to be disappointed. That disappointment can lead to resentment down the road. And that hurts both us and it hurts the recipient who we are trying to give to. With no expectations, there's no expectations to outcome, and everyone enjoys the benefits of that generosity. Like, we also know what it's like to receive a gift where there's strings attached. It doesn't feel as good to be the receiver of that either, or the giver. So the more transactional the giving is, the more there's opportunities for unhappiness or exploitation. And I actually remember back when I was in probably second grade, I remember this kid. So I grew up, my mom's actually in the audience tonight, and I was the kid who always got like carrot sticks for my snack or celery sticks. Sounds like no one can relate to that at all either. And everyone else, of course, got what? They got like Twinkies and all kinds of awesome stuff. And so no one would want to trade their snack with me. And then partway through the year, this one kid started trading his Twinkies for my carrot sticks and celery. And I was like, this is a great deal, right? This is amazing. And at some point, my parents kind of got wind at this, right? Told them what a great deal I had. And they kind of expressed their disappointment. Not that I was eating Twinkies, right? That was part of it probably. But more that, right, this was not really fair to this kid, right? This was not a real honest transaction. Like, he wanted friendship, and I wanted Twinkies, but I didn't want friendship so much, and he probably really didn't want those carrot sticks, right? So it just, you know, this more transactional kind of giving, or when we have this sort of expectation, it kind of creates more unhappiness, a more inner, just that kind of icky feeling that we get. And when I look at my own life with honesty, and I encourage you also to kind of look back, and you look at your record with generosity, you know, I tend to see actually really the only times I've gotten resentful, the only times I kind of regretted giving something, are when I was expecting something in return. That's when I regretted that gift, because I thought there'd be something kind of in it for me. And so, again, we all do that, but figuring out how can we step a bit away from that? Because, again, I was attached. I was attached to that IOU. I was, like, holding on to that chit. Like, even, you know, like, as a kid, I actually remember, like, writing IOU on a piece of paper and putting it in my wallet, right, when someone owes you money. Right? Holding on to that. And that only creates more suffering for the person in debt and the person holding the debt. So what's the kind of giving that you're doing? Right, that we're doing? Are there invisible strings? Are there expectations? Right, and that's not necessarily a problem, but it's just trying to be aware of this kind of giving when we're doing it. And again, you know, kind of helping, you know, kind of trying to figure out for ourselves, how do we discern all of this? And that's again where we can turn to our practice and kind of weigh it. How does this feel if I think about this gift? Does it feel like there's no strings? Or does it feel like there's something in there? And we have our Sangha, we have our community. Or we have these really helpful words of wisdom from the Dharma, from the Paramis, about generosity. So Buddhism also divides three generosity into three types of gifts that we can give. The first is the gift of wealth or material, the gift of stuff. The second is the gift of protection, of spiritual or emotional support and physical protection. And the third is the gift of wisdom, the gift of Dharma. And these are also kind of like so much in these traditions, right? The near enemies, or they have their kind of inverse, you know, kind of greeds as well, right? We can be materially greedy. We can also be kind of like emotionally and spiritually greedy as well. Like, you know, I gotta soak up all that wisdom and meditate till I get enlightened, and then, you know, or whatever. Like, we can kind of get into that spiritual materialism. So all of these categories, though, the Buddha advises that we share what we can afford to, and we share the best of what we have. We share the best stuff, the best support, the best spirit, and the best wisdom. And of course, you know, there's no loopholes in here. All these spiritual traditions are about, you know, kind of percentage, right? Not actual amount, right? We want to give in kind of relation to the amount that we can give. And this is also tricky. I think a lot of us can kind of attach to an identity as givers or generous people or caregivers. But that can also cause its own suffering, right? We can give so much either wealth or safety or wisdom or emotional support or even wisdom that causes ourselves suffering or causes the people around us suffering. I'm a psychotherapist, and one of my clients talks about her parents were these incredible activists, right? They were giving so much to the world, to all these other kids in the world, but she felt kind of slighted in that process, right? And so thinking about, you know, how's our generosity, like, is it on balance to everyone around us? And I think it's helpful, you know, there needs to be enough that we feel like kind of a pinch, right? Like just, you know, it's like going to the gym, right? If I go like this, I'm not building muscles, but if I have enough of a weight, I need to feel a little bit sore after I go to the gym. I don't want to not be able to get out of bed the next day, right? But just like feel that, you know, there was some resistance there and push ourselves through that. Like that's kind of the amount that we want to give. We need to be able to feel it. It has to hurt just a little bit. That's what kind of builds the giving muscle, makes it stronger. And even the Dalai Lama, he has some quote where he says, you know, don't just be kind and generous because it's the right thing to do, but it's important for you. Like this is good for you to be kind and generous. But it really has to be authentic or it doesn't count spiritually. And it also, like I'm really interested in the research on this stuff, if it's not authentic giving, it also doesn't count in terms of like what's happening in our brains, what happens psychologically. So the gift of wealth, right? We all have something we can give. And, you know, that material can mean many things. It can mean money, it can mean things, medicine, shelter, knowledge, time, even our bodies in some ways. Giving wisdom, i.e., I'm actually a pretty introverted person, and it was a number of years ago that someone, it kind of made sense to me, someone said, you know, sharing what you have, that's actually a gift. Keeping it to yourself is selfish. We want to have the right boundaries about that, of course, right? But actually speaking, opening up, sharing our experience, sharing our wisdom, right? That actually really is a potential gift. I also think about the gifts of youth or the gifts of strength. When I was much younger, I had no money. I was a graduate student. And I kind of realized that when you're young, you've got time and no money. And when you're older, you've got money and no time. And I kind of tried to figure out how to live my life according to this principle. And I was really interested in going on retreats and gaining sort of more spiritual wisdom and all of that. And so I couldn't afford the retreats, but I would try to give back what I could. I would volunteer to do chores and stuff like that after the retreats. And this was good for the retreat center because they got some free labor. They got some young people in the door. And they also got like a good, loyal kind of future audience who gives back. And I got benefits too, right? I got the opportunity to sit on a retreat and to feel that I earned it, that I'd been at the retreat and not just been a total freeloader about it, which might have made me feel even more entitled the next time. And so instead, we both got to kind of feel generous, and we both got to kind of develop some merit in the process. But if they had just said, like, oh, come for free, it's no big deal, like in some ways, I feel like I probably would have been less invested than if I'd known I had to do chores at the end of it. And even the research kind of is backs this up, that it's important to contribute to anything, even just a small amount. It's called kind of the skin in the game principle from neuroeconomics. But it is important. As a therapist, it's important that people pay at least a little bit for their therapy, or they'll really get something out of it because they've made some kind of investment in it. And so, you know, what I gave was my body and my strength. And that can mean many different things. Maybe it's not to a Dharma center, but maybe it's, you know, carrying an aging neighbor's groceries, or offering to shovel or something like that. You don't have to give everything of your body. Although the Nagarjuna Bodhisattva, there was some Bodhisattva who donated their eyeballs to the good. And you don't have to donate every organ, but you can think about it. But it is true that when we are giving and trying to be altruistic for ourselves and others, it actually kind of like doubles the amount that we're able to find. So this one Bodhisattva pointed out, a thirsty person looking for water for himself will find it. But a thirsty person who's looking for water and for others will look harder and eventually find more water. And these altruistic motives are actually wired into us and even proven in the research. When we're doing for ourselves, we'll do only so much, but when we're doing for our family and for others, we're more likely to do more when we include ourselves in that. It's not just giving to others, it's giving to ourselves and others. Right? Just as we send compassion, not just to others, but we start that circle of compassion with ourselves. So giving can mean wealth or donations, give things, share things to friends. And science also has suggestions for what to give. As far as gifts go, it's just past the gift-giving season, but there's some interesting research that says when we give experiences, that actually gives more happiness to people than giving material gifts. Like giving tickets or giving a membership to a museum or giving an art class or a cooking class or a meditation class. These actually are a better investment in that person's happiness than just giving them a thing. So those are some of the material gifts we can consider. The second form of generosity is offering protection to those in physical or emotional danger. We might call this the gift of fearlessness. Right? We experience this as altruism. And a lot of us, again, are wired in with this altruistic drive to protect our children, to protect our friends, to protect our families. There's a dark side of this also. Right? But so many people, even if you don't necessarily have a family, right? This is what drives doctors and nurses, social workers, police officers, teachers, right? So many people, even some politicians, believe it or not, right, are driven to give and to help through that altruistic motive. To give others a life of safety and freedom from fear. So this research on altruism is also really interesting. But you don't have to make a career in giving others freedom from fear. Right? This has its own challenges too. We can offer a friend, we can give them an ear to listen, we can give them a shoulder to cry on. We can hold the pain of others, we can help keep them safe. We can give a smile to a friend or a stranger. That can change an entire person's day, right? We can give emotional comfort and encouragement to the people around us, our partners or colleagues. We can hold the door for someone, let someone in a rush cut ahead of us in line, feed a stranger's meter, and all these kinds of things like that. So for a long time when I was younger, I thought that generosity meant just like writing checks or volunteering in a soup kitchen or dropping change in a beggar's dish in Harvard Square. But the Buddha also said we want to give the best of what we have. And when I was younger, that probably was the best of what I had. But I also look at my life now, I've got other skills. I've got other things I can offer. I can give the best of what I've got. I can do some pro bono consulting. I can offer friends some free mental health advice or something like that. Or I can mentor a younger colleague. Right? These are other ways that we can give. And again, this is all in balance. Right? I have a family now. That's changed some of my priorities in some ways. But there are many things that we can give. We have all kinds of gifts. The Buddha said everyone has something they can give, and I think that's not just stuff. It's that we all have gifts. Right? There is something special we all have. We can also give the gift of presence. I'm a psychotherapist, as I mentioned. And the job of the psychotherapist, and actually how it works, is that we're giving someone presence. We're giving someone absolute, unconditional, compassionate presence for 45 minutes, for an hour. And that's transformative. That's healing. that presence, that relationship is actually what works in therapy. But that's what also works in friendships and, you know, in all of our relationships. Right? So we can give that gift of presence to the people in our lives. We can set down our phones and give them our absolute attention. And we can give that gift of presence to ourselves. That's what we try to do on our cushions, right? Tonight or, you know, those other times that we sit and practice. We give ourselves some presence. What's it like to be with myself? It's not always as fun as we'd like it to be, right? But that's a gift that we give ourselves. We can give people presence and time and space. Thich Nhat Hanh says, the most precious gift we can offer anyone is our attention. When mindfulness embraces those that we love, they'll bloom like flowers. And so again, back to that best of what we have, right? That's giving our best time, our best presence. Not that kind of half texting, half watching TV, doing something else presence, but really our full presence, being fully present. Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that we can give simply by saying, darling, I am here for you. We give our presence and attention to those around us. And this can be in a tall order when we're asked to give our attention to our jobs, our things, our telephones, right, all these other things, our bank accounts, right, but really just kind of slowing down, just really giving attention to the people we love and giving attention to those other people in our life. For a long time, I used to, like, whenever I was doing chores, I just, like, put on my earbuds and listen to my podcast, sometimes on, like, double speed so I could absorb, like, twice as much wisdom. And I go to the supermarket, and then I realized, you know, I'm missing out on kind of what's actually happening in this moment. And these interactions I could be having with the checkout person, with the barista, I could be giving them my presence. I could ask them how their day is and actually mean it, right? Listen for that answer. That's really giving them something. So that's kind of become my practice in these last few years, just like really giving presence, giving attention, not just to the people I love, but to other people who I interact with. And certainly if you've ever worked in retail, you know how special that is when you get that attention. It can change your day. So generosity is not just the antidote to greed, but the antidote to anger and resentment. Right? We can give to people who frustrate us, who tick us off. We can give them the benefit of the doubt. That's another thing we can give. That coworker who seems so nasty, or that difficult neighbor or in-law, we can give them the benefit of the doubt. It's another gift we can offer. And when we do that, we encourage them to also then give us the benefit of the doubt, or give others the benefit of the doubt. And we can give space and time. When we have a conflict with someone that we love, we can also give them some space. I learned something about the Zen art of flower arranging, and it's not the flowers that make the arrangement beautiful. It's the space around them. We can give people some space. We can step back. We can give them that so that they can blossom, that they can heal when we need them to. And then lastly, this highest form of generosity is wisdom. Or Dharma, or other wisdom traditions. These give us freedom and liberation, like the old saying about teach a man to fish. Right, and this is really the most important thing we can offer. We can do something for someone, or we can teach them the skills and the wisdom that they'll need for their own independence, freedom, liberation, to not have to be dependent. And so that teaches so much in that way. And this also, when we give people independence and freedom, this kind of, the idea is that this karmically generates even more wisdom and compassion in the world. When we allow someone to find their own path or find their own wisdom, we've created another path. We've created our own path and their path. And they can then share that. It's got this like karmic doubling effect that's really kind of incredible. Right? They get a wisdom that's their wisdom that they can use in the face of life challenges for themselves. And so this wisdom, right, when we share it, it becomes kind of exponential, rippling out. So the Buddha said we all have something we can give away, right? Maybe that's like that old pair of underwear with holes in it, right? But it's also that we all have something we can offer. Every living being has intrinsic value. Wisdom we've acquired the hard way. Everyone in this room has that. Everyone in this room has wisdom, a gift that they can share. We've all lived a gift of life. We've lived a life of joy and sorrow. We've got wisdom from those that we can share. And so part of generosity is giving our wisdom away. In fact, wisdom is one of those things we only keep by giving it away. Right? It's how we hold on to it. It's why I love writing and love this kind of work, because it helps me become more wise. It's like, oh, I never thought about it that way. Right? And then there's kind of more wisdom that gets generated. So all of these types of generosity, when we practice them wisely, right, they bring us happiness. They build that muscle of generosity and bring us more happiness and openness. And we can just, you know, share that hard-won wisdom from our own suffering, right? When we hear about someone, a friend or a friend of a friend, maybe who's suffering, right? Oh, I know I've had that illness. Maybe I can reach out. Maybe I can offer them my phone number, or my kid was sick. Maybe I can share my experience, or listen, right? Sometimes the gift of listening is more helpful than even the gift of sharing or trying to share wisdom. So there's also complications. There's near enemies of generosity, false generosity. Another problem is we don't want to give so much that we deplete ourselves. We want to give in balance. We want to give within our means, right? Just enough that we feel that pinch, as I said. But there's also some kind of common pitfalls. And these come from a good place. Once we start giving, it actually becomes easy to kind of keep being generous because we notice that it feels good. This actually happens. We start being generous, we start being more generous. We get a kind of feedback loop going in our brains. I don't want to give anyone my cough, excuse me. I'm not contagious. I was diagnosed with whooping cough, though, which I thought only existed on, like, the Oregon Trail. But anyway, I am not contagious. So we have this tendency to keep, you know, chasing things that feel good, and we can actually do that with giving sometimes. We get that gratitude, we get that recognition sometimes, and that can reinforce us. It can reinforce our sense of identity as a generous person. Right? That gets a little bit tricky. But we want to make space for others to be generous too. You know, give other people a chance to give us gifts. For some of us, it's hard to receive gifts or hard to receive compliments. We can be generous by letting other people give us those things. I was working at a teen retreat a couple of years ago, and there's this interesting experience. If you haven't worked on a teen retreat, I highly recommend it. It's an amazing experience. I was feeling kind of like an outsider. We were having our staff meeting, and there's this one kid that was kind of having a difficult time emotionally. And I felt like, oh, I got this. Like, I'm a therapist. I can talk to this kid. Finally, I've got, like, a role. I can be helpful. And I kind of, you know, first, you know, kind of put up my hand, like, I can talk to him. Like, I'm a professional. And then I kind of realized through this conversation that there's this other person who was volunteering on the retreat, and they'd already been kind of developing a relationship with this kid. And I was kind of like stepping on her opportunity to be generous. I get to work with kids every day in my job. She gets to do this once a year when she goes on this teen retreat. And that I was being kind of selfish in my generosity almost. Right? And trying to then I just kind of like backed off and said, oh, you know, you should really chat with this kid. Let me know if you need some support. Right? And trying to, you know, give someone else a space to be generous. It doesn't have to be me being the generous one all the time. And that's hard for those of us who are naturally generous, or who we want to feel like we're a generous person. But it can also be its own kind of twisted narcissism or martyrdom in some way. So we can give opportunities to others. I think about the story of the Buddha. Also, people know his story, you know, what kind of world was he born into? He was born into this life of incredible privilege. And his parents, like, literally kept him behind the palace walls. He literally grew up in a gated community, like, 3,000 years ago. And he encountered suffering and went out into the world, and he renounced what he had. He gave away all his stuff. Right? And he couldn't kind of fully give away his privilege and his stature, but he tried to do that. But I think about that too. Like, I'm an overeducated American white male, right? Married to a woman. I paid off my student loans. Like, I've got everything going for me. I'm incredibly privileged. Right? That's something I can't, like, get rid of that, but I can share that privilege. Right? I can offer that to, you know, I can step back. I can make space for people without it. That's another thing that can be generous that I can do, or that many of us can do. Right? We can elevate other voices. We can elevate different people who haven't traditionally been heard or historically been heard in our culture. That's also an opportunity to practice generosity, to bite my lip, you know, to try to, you know, point out that someone else made that idea first. Right? These are other ways I can try to, you know, use what I do have, which is my privilege, to share and be generous in some way. And of course, as I said, oversharing, overgiving has its own hazards. Right? And when we think about giving the best of what we have, if we give everything, then there's not any best left. Right? We have to give in a kind of middle path kind of way. So being aware of that. Another kid that I work with a couple of years ago, he was this really sweet kid. He kind of had everything going for him in life, but he just couldn't make friends at all. And that was kind of what he was doing in therapy. And after a few meetings, he kind of confessed that this group of guys he'd been hanging out with, they kind of dropped him from their circle. And they stopped returning his texts, and he just kind of, like, his eyes welled up, and he was just saying, I don't understand. Like, I always bought them beer. I always paid for dinner. I'd give them rides whenever they needed it. I was so generous. That's what friends do. Right? But, like, we all know that kind of kid, right? Or that kind of adult, right? I was really struggling with how to, I don't feel like I handled it very well, you know, try to talk to him about that without shaming him or telling him not to be generous, but I've thought about it a lot over the years, and in some ways, like, you know, he was not kind of making space for other people to be generous too, right? And then that set himself up to be kind of taken advantage of in these other ways. So we want to just be aware of that, because if we're too generous, it does create those conditions under which we can get taken advantage of. So finding opportunities, creating opportunities to give. And this is not so easy in our culture. In Burma or Thailand, right, in the Buddhist tradition, right? People have ever been there, you see the monks all getting their begging bowls out and going out on their alms rounds, getting food, and that's, you know, that the monks are doing this act of generosity by earning merit for everybody through their practice, and the people in the town are earning their merit by being generous to support the monks in their quest to do that. Right? But we don't have quite that culture around us. So we can think about, like, really, how do we start to be generous in this culture? Ajahn Brahm says, our practice can be like the sun. It shines in all directions. And the sun also shines inward. And so it shines close and it shines at a distance. But that means, though, that we do start with ourselves. Right? Maybe we want to give ourselves an act of generosity. Give ourselves material. Get ourselves a comfy sweater, a comfy chair. Save for retirement. We can give ourselves freedom from fear by getting ourselves the emotional support that we need. Maybe that's taking a mental health day, giving ourselves presence, spending time with a spiritual teacher, friend, healer. And we can give wisdom to ourselves, right? Places like this or in the books that we read. We can try to live that wisdom in our lives. So consider for yourself just what is one generous thing you can do for yourself when you get home or this week? And then consider expanding that outward. So the Buddha himself said, don't act on greed and do act on generous impulses. And he said also there's joy in contemplating generosity, and then the action, and then the memory of generosity. Sylvia Boorstein suggests 5 times a day to find an unplanned act of generosity, which I really love. And we can also recall acts of generosity that we've received as well as that we've given. Maybe it's, you know, kind of some of the traditions of generosity that exist in your family, thinking about that. So in the title of this talk, I also mentioned something about karma and generosity and kindness. And so I want to shift gears a little bit over to that and how kindness and generosity and what this means in terms of karma. And I've been sitting for many years, and a long time ago I asked a meditation teacher, what's the deal with karma? And they were basically like, well, it's not like if you cut someone off in traffic, you don't get a parking spot. And I've kind of thought about that a lot. But over the years, I've actually started to kind of look into this and discovered maybe like a different answer to this question. So I know I said I'd talk a little bit about Cambridge driving and parking, so I want to make good on that promise as well. So we've all probably had that experience where we're driving and someone cuts us off. And in that moment, we're faced with a dilemma of generosity, right? Like, do we go ahead and let them in, or do we just keep cutting them off? And, you know, this is how we make that decision is like kind of built on a number of different factors. There's a ton of different causes and conditions for why we do that. Some of it's, you know, kind of nature and nurture, and some of it's kind of what went on with us that morning. What did we eat? What's our mood like? All these kinds of things. Some of it's kind of how we're wired genetically. And so, you know, we're wired actually in terms of our genetics to be a little bit more aggressive or to be a little bit more generous, and that also kind of interacts with our nurture. But where do we even kind of get our genetic material from? And what's interesting is that there's this subfield of genetics called epigenetics. People heard about epigenetics a little bit? So epigenetics studies the way our gene expression, not our genes themselves, but the expression of our genes, changes in relation to our experiences. And one of the experiments found, these researchers took some happy, well-adjusted, genetically identical mice, and they stressed out half of them. Not such a nice thing to do. And these mice started acting differently. They started acting more aggressively and stressed out than the other mice. But what they noticed was that the mice's children and the mice's grandchildren actually exhibited these same kind of more aggressive qualities. And so these started to get kind of passed on generation to generation. And so part of what this means is that in terms of like karma and all of that, well, some of our ancestors' experience might actually have reshaped the way their DNA expressed itself. And that in turn was passed on to your parents and even on to you in terms of how you respond to stresses in life like traffic, these kinds of things. And if you think back over your family history, a lot of us have traumatic immigrations or war or slavery or genocide, poverty. And these traumas and stresses might have impacted the DNA that you're actually carrying. So you take that genetic setup and kind of combine it with your nurture and the experiences of your life, the modeling that you got, and you know, whether you're a meditator, things like that, what kind of day you had, and then maybe you choose to cut that person off in traffic. But what else happens when we do something unkind is it affects how we feel. And it actually does affect our brain as well and starts to rewire our brain. If I do something not so nice today, it actually starts to rewire my brain that it's easier to kind of push through that barrier tomorrow, and I'm more likely to do that same thing tomorrow. If I cut someone off in traffic, I'll probably cut them off again in traffic tomorrow. And this is also true in terms of the epigenetics. This guy from Hopkins says, if you think about the stress system preparing you for fight or flight, the epigenetic changes prepare you to fight harder or flee faster the next time you encounter something stressful. So we get this kind of spike in our nervous system. And when we get that spike of stress, cortisol, that blocks a hormone called oxytocin. Does anyone know what oxytocin does? Oxytocin's like the love hormone. Lets us feel kind of warm and fuzzy and attached to other people and want to be kind and generous. And so, right, we're kind of, you know, if we don't get that, right, if we're acting unkindly, then we're less likely to be generous. And that means we're kind of more pessimistic about the world, and, you know, we're kind of unpleasant to be around. And these negative behaviors and positive behaviors are also contagious. So if I cut someone off in traffic, right, they're actually more likely to then, like, snap at their husband when they get home. And he's more likely to send the kids up to bed without any dessert. And they're more likely to kind of, you know, wake up unhappy and be in a grumpy mood the next day. And their DNA is a little bit more likely to express itself differently, be a little bit more stressed out and aggressive going forward. But we can also look at the inverse of this. So maybe I start out my day, I get a good night's sleep, and I'm healthy. Maybe some of my grandparents have lived through some traumas, but they got therapy, or they got help, or they took up meditation, something like that. They worked out their demons, and their DNA didn't have a chance to express itself and pass this message on to be more aggressive. And so then that means that, you know, my childhood was presumably full of secure attachments and minimal trauma. And maybe also my family, as they did, right, taught me compassion and generosity. Maybe I had a good day that day before I pulled out into traffic. And so I was in a good mood. And that thing happened, and I was able to kind of respond rather than react, and I didn't have the cortisol spike. And that meant oxytocin, that love hormone, was actually able to flow. And so I was able to say and kind of think a little bit more clearly, like, maybe that person trying to cut me off is just rushing their sick kid to the hospital today. And I say, go ahead, and I wave them into traffic. And so just after I wave them in and do something kind and do something generous, some amazing things happen. That brain hardwires that new habit of generosity. New neural pathways make it more likely I'll be generous and kind tomorrow. And I also get this hit of some different neurotransmitters and hormones. I get the hit of serotonin, which regulates mood and anxiety. I get oxytocin, which kind of, you know, feel all warm and fuzzy for a couple hours. And I get dopamine, which is part of the reward mechanism. And so that feels good as well. Also strengthens my immune system, makes me feel safe enough to, like, kind of give something up and let them in. And I feel good because I've done a good deed. And so what this means is then that person who's experienced that good deed, there's actually these researches, James Fowler and Nick Christiakis wrote this incredible book about social contagions and how behavior spreads from person to person to person. And they found that one act of generosity can actually be statistically traced. These are like real research. These are like Harvard School of Public Health and Emory guys. These are like legit people. One act of generosity actually traces down three people. They can actually measure that. So that I let that person go, this is called upstream reciprocity, excuse me. I let that person go in traffic, they're, you know, a little bit nicer to their husband who gives the kids extra dessert, who go to bed happy, who don't kick the dog on the way up the stairs, who wake up happier and healthier and more resilient, and pass on that genetic material kind of to the next generation. And so this kindness also, there's so much research on this. We actually get more out of giving than we get in receiving. There was one study that gave research subjects, they had $5. They said, you can spend this, you can give this to someone, or you can keep it for yourself. And what really surprised everyone, the researchers as well as the people in the experiment, was that those who gave it away actually felt much better than the ones who kept it. And Richie Davidson, who's an incredible researcher at the University of Wisconsin on all kinds of contemplative practice, he says, the best way to activate positive emotion circuits in the brain is through generosity. So we do that generous thing. We let them go in traffic. We're happier and more optimistic. The people around me are happier. My family's happier. And I get social reinforcement. The genes don't kind of send those mean genes onward. And I go home. People are happy. But this doesn't get to the question of parking, which is kind of this other fun study. And so when we're happy and we're optimistic, what happens is that we actually kind of notice things more. We actually notice opportunities more often. There's this one study by a guy named Richard Wiseman, very apt study for a name for a researcher, and he studies optimists and pessimists. And he gave them all a newspaper and said, count the number of photographs in this newspaper. And that's sort of your job. And the pessimist took like 3 or 4 minutes to count all 47 photos in the newspaper. But the optimist got the job done in like 30 seconds. So what's the catch? So the optimist actually, like on the second page of the newspaper, there's a little ad that says, stop counting those 47 pictures in this newspaper. But the pessimists didn't notice it. They just skipped right over it. But the optimists, the people who were happier, they saw that opportunity just as it was arising. So that you, if you're like cutting someone off in traffic, you're gonna feel bad, but if you let that person go, you're gonna feel good. And by the time you get to Central Cambridge and someone pulls out of that parking spot in front of you, you're more likely to notice it because you're happier than the person who didn't. So maybe everyone got parking tonight because you were kind and generous and compassionate in traffic. So this was kind of inspired by a good friend of mine. This friend of mine, she used to sit here. She's an atheist Muslim. She grew up in Pakistan where she went to Catholic school. And she's in 12-step recovery and she practices Buddhist meditation. She believes in like everything and nothing. But she does one thing, she practices kindness. And that actually kind of inspired, you know, this part of the talk tonight, which is that her one act of kindness every day is that she just lets someone go in front of her in traffic at a green light, right? Which of course we know in Cambridge, that's like, you know, whatever you believe, that's like the highest form of reincarnation. Like that light over there on Hampshire Street, like if you let someone go there, like you're gonna, I don't know what you're gonna be in the next life, but it's like gonna be incredible, or like, you know, seventh heaven or whatever it is. So just even those small acts of kindness, those small acts of generosity, right? They impact us. The karma ripples inward, affects how we feel and actually rewires our brain. It affects the people around us, right? That even just actually just witnessing an act of generosity still has that same downstream effect, three people. And then also kind of doesn't wire our DNA to be kind of, you know, aggressive and angry. And so we pass on to the future generations just through one act of kindness, maybe in a little bit more friendly DNA that actually can really kind of change the future of the world. So these one small acts of generosity can really be incredibly powerful. So that's generosity and my scientific explanation of karma. And that's also 8:30, so thank you all very much.